Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Top government officials have been using Signal, a privately owned, encrypted messaging app, to communicate top-secret information. This was discovered after the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, was accidentally added to a chat about a pending attack in Yemen. The White House continues to downplay the messages, insisting that what was said in the chat was not classified and did not cause any harm. But now the American people are left to wonder if anything is going to come of this. Will there be hearings, resignations, new regulations, or will things continue business as usual? Joining us now is Shane Harris, a staff writer at The Atlantic, who has been reporting alongside Jeffrey Goldberg on the recent Signal leak. Welcome to All Sides, Shane.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. So this was a group chat between a lot of people were in there, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, National Security Advisor Michael Walls, and other members of the security team. And somehow The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg finds himself in the chat seemingly out of nowhere. Now, 1 week later, does your colleague Jeffrey still believe that he was added to the chat as a random accident?
I think that is still our working presumption, because I can't really think of a reason why anyone would want any journalist, but maybe particularly Jeff Goldberg, given his particular history with the president, to be in that room. But these officials who were involved in Mike Waltz, the national security advisor, have not really given a clear explanation for how he was added. So that remains a mystery.
Now, in the chat, they're talking about attack on the Houthi militia in Yemen. And at first, Jeffrey thought it was not real. And then a short time later, after the attack actually happened, that's when he realized the chat was real. Is that correct?
That's right. And initially, I think we both thought it was a hoax. He came to me shortly after he was added to the room on March 13th. And we both kind of immediately recognized it as purportedly, this PC in the title stands for Principals Committee, and it looked like all the principals who would be involved in planning for operations in Yemen were in the room. But yes, we initially thought this could be some kind of elaborate hoax.
Mm. Now, if they had been talking about anything else, this would have probably blown over. But can you tell us why talking about an attack in Yemen in this group chat became problematic?
Well, I think for starters, it is the case that senior officials obviously have discussions about military operations, and these are exactly the people who would have been involved. But the adding somebody who wasn't supposed to be in the conversation was a pretty clear security breach. And it's worth noting, I think, that had they incidentally added somebody else who had been in Mike Waltz's contact book, maybe a foreign government, someone from an intelligence agency, maybe one that's not exactly an ally to the United States, this information could have conceivably have gotten out prior to the attack in Yemen, which would have given the Houthi forces time to respond and potentially prepare a counterattack. Information like what is in this signal chain is the kind of thing that the military normally keeps secret to safeguard the lives of U.S. forces involved in the operation. So that's why this is really, I think, so significant, as the information, had it gotten out widely before the strike, could have jeopardized the lives of the U.S. forces participating in that strike.
Right. So if he would have accidentally added someone who knew someone who knew someone involved in Yemen, it could have been disastrous for our military.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that the Russians are providing information to Iran, which is a big proxy backer of the Houthis. We can all imagine how once information gets out, and you put it really well, Amy, somebody who knows someone, that information could travel very quickly once you let it outside of a closed circle. And frankly, had there been a less scrupulous journalist than Jeff in the room, he could have just tweeted the whole thing if he wanted to, and that would have been potentially quite disruptive, to say the least, to what the U.S. military was about to do.
I suppose that's true. He could have just taken screenshots of each page of the chat and just been like, look at this, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, instead of just kind of sitting there quietly, and some people have said, well, why didn't he alert immediately that he was in the room? I mean, again, we didn't know what was going on here. And I should say, too, that once it was very clear, based on the fact that bombs were falling in Yemen at around the same time that Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, had told the room that they would, at that point, Jeff removed himself from the chat once we had really verified its authenticity.
Yeah, Jeffrey Goldberg was interviewed by The Daily. That's a podcast and public radio show produced by The New York Times. And here's what he said in that interview program about leaving the group chat.
I assumed at that point that Mike Waltz was going to call and say, hey, who is this? Or call and say, why'd you leave the group? And then I would say, you know, Director Waltz or whatever, do you even know who this is? But nobody, look, I mean, here's the truth of it is nobody noticed when I was added and nobody noticed when I was left.
Yeah. What do you make of that? That nobody noticed, or like nobody, people were talking freely and not noticing the names of who was in this group.
What I take from that is that this Signal chat is not a unique instance. I mean, at no point in the conversation does anyone raise concerns about why they're having such sensitive discussions on a commercial text app. And while Signal is secure and end-to-end encryption and all of that, these are conversations that normally occur in the Situation Room of the White House or on secure government conferencing systems, and no one bats an eye at what's going on. So I think that this is probably somewhat routine. The Wall Street Journal, interestingly, reported over the weekend that Mike Waltz, according to officials, has created other chats like this. I think people in the room didn't even notice who was coming and going because maybe this is the kind of activity they engage in pretty frequently.
Now, Jeffrey, do you know if he has exchanged phone numbers with Mike Waltz? Like, has he talked to him on his cell phone, or are they like close enough that they have each other's contact information?
Well, I can't say how exactly his contact information ended up in Mike Waltz's phone. I simply don't know. But they have met before around Washington. I mean, it's a small town. Mike Waltz was a congressman from Florida. You know, Jeff has said they've encountered each other at events around town. I don't know that they are especially close. I don't think that there's any kind of ongoing relationship. But, you know, that's a pretty straightforward explanation for how a journalist ends up in a congressman's phone. It's just, you know, you're sort of around town. Maybe you've exchanged numbers. But I don't think that Mike Waltz's more sort of elaborate explanations, including my number, I think he said was somehow Jeff's number was sucked into his phone. I don't think that makes any sense.
Yeah. And is using Signal something the Atlantic does? Do you all have chats in there, or is it just another app that some people use?
Well, it's a very useful tool for journalists, especially because it provides really secure end-to-end encryption. But when, you know, I use it or other colleagues use it, you know that it's only as secure as the device on which it's running. So if your phone is hacked, for instance, in a way that lets the intruder see messages that are being typed and received, the encryption does you no good. Now, if you lost your phone and somehow those messages fell into someone's hands, that would be, you know, kind of defeat the purpose of Signal. So it's a tool, and it's a good tool, but it's not perfect. And, you know, would we conduct you know, highly, highly sensitive conversations like this in Signal? I don't think we would. I think we would opt for doing that face to face. But is it a good way for journalists to do their work and be contacted by anonymous sources or stay in touch with people when they're traveling? Yeah, it actually is pretty good for that. And previous administrations have used it to share unclassified, more kind of logistical information or to talk around something sensitive until they could get together in a secure place and speak.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the leak of sensitive national security information from a group chat on the app Signal. With us is Shane Harris, a staff writer for The Atlantic, who is reporting alongside Jeffrey Goldberg on the recent Signal leak. So at first, The Atlantic chose not to publish the entire text chain, but what changed the mind of your team to publish the full text?
It was really a couple major factors. One was that, to my surprise, once we published our initial story, which described the text but didn't print all of them, administration officials came out and said all the information in that chat was unclassified, which I found stunning. And because, you know, I've reported on national security for 25 years, if the information in this chain is not classified, then I don't know what classified information is. And they have offered no explanation for why it was unclassified or if it was affirmatively declassified by someone before they put it in there. So essentially, the administration was saying, look, there's nothing here that is sensitive. But I think also they were mischaracterizing what the messages themselves said and suggesting that we at The Atlantic were lying to readers in the way that we were characterizing them. So I think that we were at a point where the only way to really refute the administration's claims and to be fully transparent with readers was to publish them and in full. And since the administration said they were unclassified, you know, I think that that to a significant degree relieved us of a lot of the burden to protect the sensitive information in it, which we had been doing.
Now, your headline called this war plans, and that seems to be what the Trump administration is like, clinging on to, saying these were not war plans. Do you agree or disagree?
I mean, we are using the war plan term colloquially, and I think, any reader probably sees that. And it's interesting to me that, Secretary Hegseth and others' counterpoint to this has been to engage in a semantic argument with us. I think any reader exercising common sense can look at this and say that these are sensitive plans describing a military operation. If you want to call that a war plan, an attack plan, we are using that term fairly colloquially. And I think that, a reader in good faith will look at these messages and understand what it is that they're describing and why they are sensitive.
Were you and your colleagues at The Atlantic surprised by the pushback? Did you think that maybe the White House would just say, yes, we made a mistake, won't happen again?
Well, I think that we thought there could be any number of routes that they might take, one of which would have been to acknowledge it, which they did very quickly, I should say, through a statement from the National Security Council, and then to just sort of, try to make it blow over. I mean, most administrations, I think, would do that. They would sort of admit the mistake or sort of begrudgingly admit it, and then not necessarily go on the counteroffensive and try to say that the messages were something other than what they were. That part was surprising. I mean, we expected pushback against The Atlantic and against Jeff, but not that the administration would just so mischaracterize what the messages were. And to be clear, they all had the messages on their phone. They could go look at it. It's not as though they were in the dark about what they said.
Now, do you know, I mean, you said you've covered national security for a long time. Whenever administrations change, is there training for new officials when they join, a highly classified U.S. national security team? Do they know what to do and what not to do from day one?
There is training that goes on, yes. There is sort of at least at a kind of rudimentary level. But these officials at this senior level will also have staff around them, or should, that have experienced these kinds of scenarios before and can guide them. They will have sensitive information facilities installed in their homes in many cases, sort of like, safe rooms where they can go in and talk without fear of having the conversations be electronically intercepted. Some of these officials, which I should note too, have served in sensitive positions. The CIA director, John Ratcliffe, who was in the chat, was the director of national intelligence in the final year of the Trump administration's first term. And frankly, I think there's just an element of common sense. I mean, everyone has been around long enough in Washington and, and seen enough in press coverage to understand that officials at these levels are presumed to be major targets of foreign intelligence services. And so they should take precautions.
So where is The Atlantic going from here? Are you I know there's been, I asked the questions at the beginning of the segment, like, will there be hearings? Will there be any changes? What will happen? The American people are left to wonder, will anything come of this? What do you think?
Yeah, I think that probably, accountability, this is an administration that has not been known for it historically. We've seen reports, and from our own reports that we've published as well, show that President Trump is not necessarily eager to fire Mike Waltz as national security advisor over this. But I think that Waltz is probably on thin ice. The Republicans control both houses of Congress, so I think hearings are unlikely. The Senate Armed Services Committee, though, notably, which, of course, is led by a Republican, Roger Wicker from Mississippi, has called for a Defense Department Inspector General investigation. But the Attorney General Pam Bondi all but said last week that there will be no investigation into this incident, which I have to say is extraordinary. I mean, in any normal circumstance, even if this was an accidental disclosure of information, the FBI would investigate it. They would look into it. I don't think that charges would be filed, actually, because the Justice Department generally doesn't disclose this kind of inadvertent disclosure of information. But the fact that it's not even being investigated, I think, really underscores that the FBI and this administration is not going to look into the behavior of senior officials in the government. So you can't expect any real accountability that way. We will just continue reporting every lead that we have and trying to understand more about how administration officials are using these signal chats. Because as I said, we don't think that this was a one-off.
Right. I mean, with the ease with which they were using it and that it had a name. And when you read through it and it says, like, who's joining? It seemed like a a normal procedure where they just said, you know, here's who it is for my team and my team. It made it seem like it is used often and frequently.
Yeah, exactly. It has the air of a conversation that is not novel, that this is the kind of thing that they've done before. And you're quite right, see it in the way when they call for points of contact, everyone just kind of sounds off with a name.
It was like a normal roll call.
It was a roll call, and nobody says, hey, why are we doing this? Or who's that JG, and why did he just leave the chat? I mean, you know, well, I can't say after he left the chat what they said, because I don't know, but everyone's acting as if this is routine. And I think that's a pretty strong indicator that, you know, it very well may be.
And the JG thing, is that just how he has his name in this app he uses for other things? Like,
That's a good question. I'm not sure if that's how Jeff has it listed, but my understanding is that that's how it would appear in Mike Waltz's phone. And you see some people showing up in the chat with their full names and some just by their initials. So I'm not sure whether that's a controlled by the user or controlled by Waltz, but you do see the mix of designations that way.
Right, because I wonder if somebody would have recognized it if it would have been his full name or if anyone would have even noticed. I guess we'll never know.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I note that, like, Marco Rubio, presumably, that's who this is, just goes by M-A-R. So those are his initials. So you do see people using both in the room.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for your time today. Shane Harris, a staff writer for The Atlantic, who's been reporting on the recent Signal leak. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Amy. It was a pleasure.
And coming up, we're going to talk about national security implications of the leak. We'll get the opinions of two experts from Ohio State. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The leak of the group chat that used the commercial messaging app Signal has caused many in Washington, D.C. and beyond to question U.S. national security. The use of the app has led to lots of questions, everything from federal record keeping to questions about the safety of military personnel around the world. The White House has downplayed the incident, saying that no classified information was discussed and calling the entire story a media hoax. But the American people are left to wonder what happens next. Joining us now is Peter Mansour, retired U.S. Army colonel. He's also the General Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair of Military History at Ohio State University. Welcome to All Sides, Peter Mansour.
Glad to be on. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Ohio State Law Professor Dakota Rudisill with the Mershon Center for International Security Studies. Welcome to All Sides, Dakota.
Great to be here.
Peter, let's start with you. So when you first heard that an Atlantic reporter had been added to a group chat with dozens of U.S. national security officials, what was your initial reaction?
My initial reaction is this is a real clown show. I mean, in only one universe can a senior editor from The Atlantic be added to a principals committee small group, and that's the one we're living in, unfortunately. So I was astonished, quite frankly.
Dakota, what about you? What was your initial reaction when you heard about the story?
Identical to Professor Mansour's. I think back to when I was in government, and especially when I was in the U.S. intelligence community, advising cabinet-level people on national security matters. The idea that you would use a commercial app to communicate about something like a military strike would just be utterly ludicrous.
Now, the White House is saying that what was in the chat was not war plans. And they're using that terminology that was in the original headline of the story. The Atlantic called them war plans. Peter, do you think that they're correct? Was it a discussion? Was it just a discussion? Were they not war plans?
They're parsing words. Mm-hmm. What they published were timelines and bomb loads for aircraft, targets on the ground. And those are pieces of war plans. They're targeting information. And they are top secret information until the operation actually unfolds. You don't want your enemies to understand who we're coming after and how we're coming after them and when we're coming after them. So the administration is simply wrong on this score. They're running for political cover and seeking any kind of parsing of terminology to squirm out of their problem.
Now, Professor Mansour, would you say that, you know, you having a different way to communicate, I mean, in this digital age, everyone is not always in the same room. Do you think that the attack they were planning on Yemen, is that something that could be communicated digitally, or do you think they should have all been in the same room talking about it?
So this is the bigger issue. Clearly, government officials have been using Signal to coordinate activities for quite some time, because it wasn't like this was unusual to any of the recipients of these texts. So they've been doing it for quite some time. Whether Signal is secure or not is debatable, but let's assume that it is. The problem here is that the cell phones aren't necessarily secure. Like a day after this all broke, a list of the telephone numbers for these officials was released online. And you know that Chinese and Russian spy agencies are going after these phones in any way that they can. So this is the bigger issue. And if the government wants to have more flexibility in how it coordinates these operations, then it needs to come up with a U.S. government app that replicates what Signal does to give its principals more flexibility. But until then, they need to go into what we call a SCIF, a secure compartmented information facility. And they have these in their homes and in their offices, and they need to coordinate that way or face-to-face in the White House sit room.
Now, Professor Rudisill, you're nodding along. So in this digital age, there has to be a secure way to talk digitally. It's just how it is today. Everyone's not in the same room. So what do you make of using Signal versus creating an app, like Professor Mansour just said?
Well, we have about an $800 billion national security budget. And since the Cold War, there have been consistent investments on the range of many billions of dollars in secure communications. And many of those are traditionally on wires. They're highly encrypted. But we also have in government wireless communication methods. Typically, those involve a big briefcase that is carried with a bunch of specialized equipment in it to make sure that communications about nuclear weapons and other sensitive matters are secure. It is entirely imaginable to me that with $800 billion that the federal government could develop something which is just as secure and is a bit more dexterous and a bit more reflective of how people in our digital age use apps. I don't think there's any question of that. It looks to me like they just didn't bother to do the work.
And what do you make of whenever you look through the chat, you know, there's emojis, there's like a roll call aspect to it. So I was talking with the Atlantic reporter at the beginning of the segment saying it seemed like everything was very familiar. You know, he organized the chat. He said, who's joining? Who should I add? He asked for names. It seemed very familiar, like they do it all the time.
There's no question about that. Everything about the way that unfolded looks like they are very familiar with one another and using this modality. And so I think that there's a much larger question here about using a commercial platform for communicating about highly sensitive matters.
And Professor Mansour, you know, the Trump administration, one of their defenses is they're saying that no confidential information was shared. But from your perspective and the people who are on the ground in Yemen doing the actual activity, do you feel like confidential information was shared?
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, the organization of the strikes, the timing of the strikes, the potential targets, all were there on the chat. So those were the most problematic elements that you don't want made public. But look at the other pieces that they're sharing. It's actually a pretty deep discussion of policy issues regarding our European allies. And while that may technically not be classified, is that something that you really want to share with the world?
Right.
You're calling our allies pathetic because they lack the capabilities to do these operations themselves.
Yeah, Professor Rudisill, the chat did not just talk about Yemen. They also, you know, Vice President Vance was in there saying things about wanting what he wanted Europe to do. Right.
Yeah. Again, there are multiple things about this that scream out classified deliberations. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are the details about the strike plans. You mentioned the comments that that Vice President Vance and the Secretary of Defense had about Europe and their capabilities and foreign policy with the Europeans. We also have a few other things. So one is that that the president made a decision on this strike matter in the Situation Room. Additionally, that we have these deliberations going on at all about when and whether to carry that out, not just the details of the bombs and the planes, but even whether to do this. And then also, according to media reports, it sounds like one of the people on the chat was a CIA officer whose identity was at the very least not publicly known. But a great number of intelligence personnel are under cover. And so having a name in there and then being so reckless as to include a journalist in this chat, right, on a platform that is not secure, it just, again, just the recklessness here is so great that a number of legal analysts have asked whether this would qualify as criminal activity under the Espionage Act, because it criminalizes gross negligence in the handling of national defense information. And I don't see how this would not qualify as that.
I'm getting mixed up in what I read where, but I believe The Atlantic chose not to reveal the name. Like, I think Jeffrey Goldberg knows the name of that CIA operative who's in the chat, but so I guess The Atlantic knew enough not to reveal the name. Is that your understanding?
So I haven't obviously seen all the social media on this. That's impossible. So initially, my understanding is that the reporter redacted some elements of it, including the CIA officer's name. But my understanding now is that the complete chat transcript, you know, images of the entire transcript right now have been published, including the names of everybody who was on there. And so if those media reports are accurate, that there was a CIA officer working for the director of the CIA whose name was on there, just enormously concerning from the standpoint of the protection of our intelligence officers. If he was technically undercover, it could potentially raise concerns about violating a criminal statute that criminalizes blowing the cover of a U.S. Government employee who is undercover. So just it is a, you know, I would just say that this is a disaster. I can't really think of anything quite like this. You know, they need to, I think, do some real reflection within the administration about how they're doing things.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the leak of national security information in a group chat that accidentally included the top editor for The Atlantic. With us is Peter Mansour, a retired U.S. Army colonel and military history professor at Ohio State, and also Ohio State Law Professor Dakota Rudisill. So I mentioned that Jeffrey Goldberg, The Atlantic's top editor, was accidentally invited to the chat. Peter Mansour, do you believe that that part of all of this, do you think it was an accident?
I do. I actually think they were trying to invite Jamison Greer, the U.S. trade representative, because they were talking about trade going through the Suez Canal, and they probably fat fingered in the wrong name. That's my guess. I have no...
The wrong JG. Yeah.
The wrong JG. Exactly. I can't see any other reason to, you know, put the senior editor of The Atlantic on this chat.
Right. In a recent interview with The Daily, that's a podcast and public radio show from The New York Times, Jeffrey Goldberg from The Atlantic was asked what he thinks will happen next. Let's listen.
It says that we're in a dangerous place. Successful countries respond to observable reality by changing course to account for that reality. If these guys go back to using Signal to discuss war planning, that's on them. That is what you would call reckless behavior. If they're going to not change certain procedures because they don't like the media or because they think that the Democrats are also bad, that doesn't sound like a healthy country. It doesn't sound like a healthy way to run a country.
Now, Professor Rudisill, those are strong words from The Atlantic's editor. Do you agree with the heart of what he was saying there?
I I think I would need to reflect on that. I would say that I think that there is a tendency with this team to regard themselves as dramatically departing from all the norms and traditions, rules and laws that have governed how American governance unfolds, right? You look at the approach that, you know, Trump and Musk and Doge have taken to downsizing federal agencies. It just blows right by, 80 years of statutory law. Hear all sorts of explanations for this about, the president ran with an agenda, which he did. I think he very clearly signaled that he was going to take a dramatically different approach to things. But then the argument is, well, he won, and so therefore he can do these things. Well, the way that American governance works under our republic is that we have the rule of law, and law continues from one group of humans in office to another group of humans, right? We have the rule of law. We don't have the rule of people. Mm-hmm. And I think that they are that there's less fidelity to that constitutional principle with this group. And I think that that's being reflected in what we're seeing here, because this is at complete variance with the rules about classified information, our norms and traditions.
Professor Mansour, what do you make of the Atlantic's editor saying, you know, that this is reckless and does not describe a healthy country?
Well, this particular episode, I would disagree with him. I think this is probably the way that government officials have been doing business, and they just finally got caught. Mm-hmm. I think this calls for the National Security Agency to look at Signal and to either declare it secure and open for use by government officials, or for the United States government to revert to what we know is secure, the various SCIFs that it uses, until it can develop an app of its own. But there's another aspect of this that, to me as a historian, is really troubling, and that is Signal chats disappear in a week. And these government deliberations, especially at the principal's level, are supposed to be archived and eventually sent to the National Archives for use by historians in the future. And I have no certainty that what is being done on Signal is being archived by this administration. I think that's very, very troubling and problematic.
Yeah, Professor Rudisill, you know, the federal record keeping, American Oversight, a nonprofit firm acting as a watchdog on federal matters, is now suing regarding this because it's breaking federal record keeping laws. You think they have a case here?
I think that they have a very strong case. There are a number of statutes that require the government to keep records. And just because the government is operating with secrecy, just because it is employing classified information, is not permission to destroy government records. A government record that is classified simply means that there are controls on who can access it, and there are well-established procedures for dealing with classified records. Either under the theory that this was classified and they massively messed up, or on their theory that there was no classified information here, it doesn't matter. Under either of those, I think anybody who wanted to bring suit or bring a case that they are violating a number of different longstanding laws in our country that are against destroying classified and unclassified records, I think they're going to have a strong case.
And I guess, Professor Mansour, there's no way to prove that they are always having these meetings in Signal and have been doing it for months, or there's no way of knowing if the Biden administration used Signal and had all of these digital conversations too. But if everything disappears after a week, we can't get it back. Is that that's what you're concerned about?
Absolutely. And now that we know this has happened at least once, I think Congress needs to step forward with investigations and then with legislation. I'm not really hopeful that will happen, given that the Republicans control Congress and they want to limit the political damage of this episode. But that's my wish.
Now, one thing that a lot of people are wondering is the accountability, the responsibility. You know, for more than a decade, Donald Trump made security breaches a key talking point against his opposition. He constantly had his rallies chanting the term "lock her up," and that might have cost Hillary Clinton the election back in 2016. Do you feel like, you know, that is going to be coming up more and more. We're going to be reminded of Hillary Clinton and her email server, Professor Rudisill.
I'm not one to predict where the internet goes, but you know, I would say contrasting those two cases, it is not a favorable comparison for this administration because the Hillary Clinton email matter. Basically, there were two issues there. One was she was using a commercial service that was privately set up in her home in upstate New York to do official business at the State Department. That was one issue. The second issue was that there was classified information which got onto some of those communications that she was sending. There were exhaustive investigations into this matter, and it looks pretty clearly like it was a mistake on behalf of the Secretary of State, Ms. Clinton, and her team. And I, as I mentioned to my students when I teach secrecy and surveillance, it was because they skipped the briefings on day one about how to recognize and handle classified information. Mm-hmm. And so that is accident. That is accident. Under the laws which govern classified information, what you basically need is intent or gross negligence. And I think what Clinton did was probably enough to get a normal government employee reprimanded, but I don't think that it was crime. What we have here is very senior officials who are very knowingly using a commercial app and for, you know, again, to discuss strike plans, a presidential decision in the sit room. It's hard to understand this as some sort of accident.
And Professor Mansour, as a military historian, when this came up, did you think back to Hillary Clinton and the phrase, but her emails, or did you even think back further than that to other things?
Actually, it's the first thing that popped up, but her emails. I actually disagree with Dakota on this one. I think these two things are very, very similar. And I don't think that the folks on the Signal chat thought that they did anything wrong. And they probably also were very ignorant of the law, just like Hillary Clinton was. So had, you know, and politically speaking, had the administration just come out and said, this was a mistake. It was a mistake having Jeffrey Goldberg on. We didn't, you know, he wasn't the guy that was intended, but it was a mistake having this on Signal at all. And we're going to take steps to make sure our communications are tightened up and more secure in the future. I think this all thing, it might not have blown over, but it certainly would have blown over a lot sooner than it is now, where the story constantly changes because something comes out. They say, well, you know, this happened or this didn't happen, and then they're caught in a lie. So this is, yeah. And then historically speaking, the other thing I was thinking of is even back to World War II, where FDR and Churchill used to talk on the phone transatlantic. They did it via some sort of device that garbled their words and made it impossible for Germans to tap into the line and understand what was being said. So as far back as the 1940s, we had these systems in place to make sure our communications were secure. And we've just decided in the 2020s that it's not worth it anymore.
And Professor Rudisill, I'll give you the last word before we take a break on that.
Well, Professor Mansour may be right that the Trump team here, like Secretary Clinton, may have been ignorant of the longstanding procedures and the law on these matters. I don't know. What I can say is that unless I'm mistaken, I'm not seeing a lawyer who is in the chat. And that is a departure from, again, longstanding approach to National Security Council Principles Committee deliberations, where you have NSC legal part of it, or you have somebody from the Justice Department. And if you would have had a lawyer there, and if they're doing their jobs, they would have raised major red flags about all the legal issues that we're talking about. So I think that that's something else to wonder about, is the extent of legal review and quality guidance from lawyers inside this administration.
All right. Well, I want to say thank you to Dakota Rudisill, Ohio State Law professor who works in the Mershon Center for International Security Studies. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
And Peter Mansour is going to stay with us, and All Sides continues in just a moment. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We've been spending this hour talking about national security in the wake of the leak of sensitive information in the group chat on the app Signal. The editor for The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, was accidentally added to the group and where they discussed the details of a combat mission in Yemen. But that's not the only conflict the U.S. is involved in. Between the Middle East and Ukraine and Russia negotiations, tensions are heating up around the world. To continue our discussion about what this information leak means for members of the military, still with us is Peter Mansour, a retired U.S. Army colonel, and he's the General Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair of Military History at Ohio State. Thanks again for being with us, Professor Mansour.
My pleasure.
So let's zoom out here for a second and look at national security as a whole. Of all the conflicts that the U.S. is involved in, or the Trump administration is trying to pull the U.S. out of, which one is top of mind for you?
I think that would be the war in Ukraine, because if Russia wins that conflict, it puts the existence of NATO at jeopardy. It puts NATO allies at jeopardy. It emboldens Russia to grab more land, maybe Poland or the Baltic states. And given this administration's feeling towards our European allies, I'm not so certain that the United States will step in to prevent any of that. So that's job number one, in my view, is bring the Ukrainian war to a successful conclusion, and barring that, to an acceptable conclusion.
A third try at a Ukrainian ceasefire has fallen through. Is Russian President Putin just dragging it out to try to win more? What do you think of these ceasefires?
Yeah, Putin has not backed off of his maximal goals for this conflict. He wants he wants pieces of Ukraine brought back into Russia and the Russian Federation. But more than that, he wants a pliable and subservient government in Kiev that will bow to his interests. And if you look at what he and his foreign minister and other officials of the Russian government are saying, they have not made any concessions at all that would bring a favorable peace or an acceptable peace in the area. They continue to say that what President Trump is doing is great and they're all for it. And then they repeat their maximalist demands.
What are your thoughts on the Trump administration's America First perspective? You know, the president wants other countries to step in. He wants other countries to step up. He does not want the world's security placed on American shoulders. Do you agree?
Oh, I don't agree. But let's just give him the benefit of the doubt that, you know, he wants to return to a United States that is that owns the Western Hemisphere. And you can kind of see that in his feelings towards Greenland and the Panama Canal and Canada. And he wants other nations, Europe and Japan and so forth, to control things in their area. The problem is they can't. They don't have the power. They may have the power one day, but that day is not this day. And by backing off U.S. commitments around the world, he's weakening our alliances, which is what has made America great in the last 80 years. It has not been American power alone. And this is something that he completely overlooks or does not understand.
Yeah, looking at the history of it all, if you look back 80 years, what does history tell us about an America First perspective? I mean, Trump can't be the first one to want to do that. So is it ever possible?
Well, we had an America First perspective in the 1930s, and the result was fascist dictatorships around the world going to war with neighboring states, eventually dragging the United States into a worldwide conflict at great cost in blood and treasure. And the American officials exiting that conflict in 1945 realized that the world needs the United States to be an active player in it. And that's not just for the world's sake, that's for the United States' sake. And so they developed these organizations such as the United Nations, NATO, and other organizations on the economic side to knit the world together and make it safer and more prosperous for everyone, but especially for the United States. And by returning to basically a failed system of America First, sort of the 1930s version, I think we're going down a path that we're going to regret.
Back to Ukraine for just a second. What do you think an acceptable peace solution would be? I mean, not that you can predict the future, but what do you think it looks like?
Well, I think at this point, Ukraine getting back their territory is not in the cards. It might have been a possibility had the Biden administration gone all in on supporting Ukraine from the beginning, but they did not, and we can't go back there. So now maybe a ceasefire in place where Russia keeps the territory that it's occupied. And then having a European peacekeeping force on the ground so that if Russia attacks again, they will be attacking not just Ukraine, but all of Europe. And then some sort of American backstop that triggers U.S. support for European forces and for Ukrainian forces should Russia attack again. Because the problem is if you say, Russia, you can have the land that you've conquered, and then you don't have any security guarantees for Ukraine, Russia will just rearm and attack again some years into the future. And they've done that before. They attacked in 2014, and then they attacked again in 2022. And, you know, 8 years from now, they'll probably attack again if they're not stopped.
Pivoting for just a couple of minutes to Gaza, on March 18th, Israel resumed bombings in the area due to a falling out of the ceasefire. What do you see as the future in Gaza and Israel with these increased strikes?
It's bleak. Israel's goal is that Hamas needs to be destroyed, that it has no political standing in the Gaza Strip, and Hamas simply doesn't want to go away. You see now some Palestinians beginning to protest publicly in Gaza, saying we don't want Hamas anymore. It's just led to death and destruction. Unfortunately, I'm not sure they have the power to force Hamas out of the territory. Mm-hmm. And so I think this conflict is going to continue for quite some time, and because the goals of each side are so irreconcilable.
Yeah,
and get rid of Hamas, or on Hamas's side, we want to control whatever entity exists once Israel leaves the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, and what do you make of the Trump administration inserting America in there, saying that that America will take over the Gaza Strip?
Yeah, that's just fantasy land. You know, in Trump's vision, you get rid of the Palestinians, and then you can develop it as a resort. Yeah, in some sort of universe, you could do that, but it would be called ethnic cleansing, and it's a crime against humanity.
In the 2 minutes we have left, I just wanted to get your take on China. You know, there's always a lot going on there, but specifically with Taiwan, do you have worries about where America's involvement is regarding China and Taiwan?
Well, I'm concerned about China's push to develop the military capabilities to do a cross-channel attack and take over Taiwan. And it's very clear that President Xi, that's his goal, to bring Taiwan into the mainland's orbit within his lifetime. So this is a very dangerous situation. And I'm not sure the signaling from the United States is all that consistent right now. And that makes for a very, very dangerous situation.
Yeah, we have a security agreement with Taiwan protecting them against China. But with the Trump administration's America First rhetoric, do you think this agreement is going to stand?
It remains to be seen, because the one thing that is consistent with this administration is its China policy. They are very tough on China, but that's in an economic sense. They haven't really shown what they want to do in a military sense vis-a-vis China. So I think that'll come out in the months to come. But if there is one thing that all American politicians can agree on today, it's that China is our major strategic competitor, and we need to ramp up our defenses for that day when China and the United States potentially go to war.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today. That was Peter Mansour, retired U.S. Army colonel and the General Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair of Military History at Ohio State University. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And this has been All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News. I want to say thank you to our student producer, Colin Simpson, who produced this show today. Thanks for joining us on 89.7 NPR News.